Christ. We felt an odd affection for them, and a sense of relief that they were being looked after in a diligent and professional manner. It seemed to mean the structure was intact. We passed a sign for the most photographed barn in America. It took an hour to funnel traffic into the single-lane approach to the camp. Mylek-suited men waved flashlights and set out day-glow pylons, directing us toward the parking lot and onto athletic fields and other open areas. People came out of the woods, some wearing headlamps, some carrying shopping bags, children, pets. We bumped along dirt paths, over ruts and mounds. Near the main buildings, we saw a group of men and women carrying clipboards and walkie-talkies, non-Mylek-suited officials, experts in the new science of evacuation. Steffi joined Wilder in fitful sleep. The rain let up. People turned off their headlights, sat uncertainly in their cars. The long, strange journey was over. We waited for a sense of satisfaction to reach us, some mood in the air of quiet accomplishment, the well-earned fatigue that promises a still and deep-lying sleep. But people sat in their dark cars, staring out at each other through closed windows. Heinrich ate a candy bar. We listened to the sound of his teeth getting stuck in the caramel and glucose mass. Finally, a family of five got out of a Datsun Maxima. They wore life jackets and carried flares. Small crowds collected around certain men. Here were the sources of information and rumor. One person worked in a chemical plant. Another had overheard a remark. A third was related to a clerk in a state agency. True, false, and other kinds of news radiated through the dormitory from these dense clusters. It was said that we would be allowed to go home first thing in the morning, that the government was engaged in a cover-up, that a helicopter had entered the toxic cloud and never reappeared, that the dogs had arrived from New Mexico, parachuting into a meadow in a daring night drop, that the town of Farmington would be uninhabitable for 40 years. Remarks existed in a state of permanent flotation. No one thing was either more or less plausible than any other thing. As people jolted out of reality, we were released from the need to distinguish. Some families chose to sleep in their cars. Others were forced to do so because there was no room for them in the 7 or 8 buildings on the grounds. We were in a large barracks, one of 3 such buildings at the camp, and with the generator now working, we were fairly comfortable. The Red Cross had provided cots, portable heaters, sandwiches, and coffee. There were kerosene lamps to supplement the existing overhead lights. Many people had radios, extra food to share with others, blankets, beach chairs, extra clothing. The place was crowded, still quite cold, but the sight of nurses and volunteer workers made us feel the children were safe, and the presence of other stranded souls, young women with infants, old and infirm people, gave us a certain staunchness and will, a selfless bent that was pronounced enough to function as a common identity. This large gray area, dank and bare and lost to history just a couple of hours ago, was an oddly agreeable place right now, filled with an eagerness of community and voice. Seekers of news moved from one cluster of people to another, tending to linger at the larger groups. In this way, I moved slowly through the barracks. There were 9 evacuation centers, I learned, including this one and the Kung Fu Palace. Iron City had not been emptied out, nor had most of the other towns in the area. It was said that the governor was on his way from the capital in an executive helicopter. It would probably set down in a bean field outside a deserted town. allowing the governor to emerge, square-jawed and confident, in a bush jacket, within camera range, for 10 or 15 seconds, as a demonstration of his imperishability. What a surprise it was to ease my way between people at the outer edges of one of the largest clusters and discover that my own son was at the center of things, speaking in his newfound voice, his tone of enthusiasm for runaway calamity. He was talking about the airborne toxic event in a technical way, although his voice all but sang with prophetic disclosure. He pronounced the name itself, niodine derivative, with an unseemly relish, taking morbid delight in the very sound. People listened attentively to this adolescent boy in a field jacket and cap, with binoculars strapped around his neck and an Instamatic fastened to his belt. No doubt his listeners were influenced by his age. He would be truthful and earnest, serving no special interest. He would have an awareness of the environment. His knowledge of chemistry would be fresh and up to date. I heard him say, "The stuff they sprayed on the big spill at the train yard was probably soda ash, but it was a case of too little too late. My guess is they'll get some crop dusters up in the air at daybreak and bombard the toxic cloud with lots more soda ash, which could break it up and scatter it into a million harmless puffs. Soda ash is the common name for sodium carbonate, which is used in the manufacture of glass, ceramics, detergents, and soaps. It's also what they use to make bicarbonate of soda, something a lot of you have probably guzzled after a night on the town." People moved in closer, impressed by the boy's knowledgeability and wit. It was remarkable to hear him speak so easily to a crowd of strangers. Was he finding himself, learning how to determine his worth from the reactions of others? Was it possible that out of the turmoil and surge of this dreadful event, he would learn to make his way in the world? What you're probably all wondering is, what exactly is this niodine D we keep hearing about? A good question. We studied it in school. We saw movies of rats having convulsions and so on. So, okay, it's basically simple. Niodine D is a whole bunch of things thrown together that are byproducts of the manufacture of insecticide. The original stuff kills roaches. The byproducts kill everything left over. A little joke our teacher made. He snapped his fingers, let his left leg swing a bit. In powder form, it's colorless, odorless, and very dangerous. Except no one seems to know exactly what it causes in humans or in the offspring of humans. They tested for years, and either they don't know for sure, or they know and aren't saying. Some things are too awful to publicize. He arched his brows and began to twitch comically, his tongue lolling in a corner of his mouth. I was astonished to hear people laugh. Once it seeps into the soil, it has a lifespan of 40 years. This is longer than a lot of people. After 5 years, you'll notice various kinds of fungi appearing between your regular windows and storm windows, as well as in your clothes and food. After 10 years, your screens will turn rusty and begin to pit and rot. Siding will warp. There will be glass breakage and trauma to pets. After 20 years, you'll probably have to seal yourself in the attic and just wait and see. I guess there's a lesson in all this. Get to know your chemicals. I didn't want him to see me there. It would make him self-conscious, remind him of his former life as a gloomy and fugitive boy. Let him bloom, if that's what he was doing, in the name of mischance, dread, and random disaster. So I slipped away, passing a man who wore snow boots wrapped in plastic, and headed for the far end of the barracks where we'd earlier made camp. We were next to a black family of Jehovah's Witnesses, a man and woman with a boy about 12. Father and son were handing out tracts to people nearby and seemed to have no trouble finding willing recipients and listeners. The woman said to Babette, "Isn't this something?" "Nothing surprises me anymore," Babette said. "Isn't that the truth? What would surprise me would be if there were no surprises. That sounds about right. Or if there were little bitty surprises. That would be a surprise, instead of things like this. God Jehovah's got a bigger surprise in store than this," the woman said.
"God Jehovah?"
"That's the one." Steffi and Wilder were asleep in one of the cots. Denise sat at the other end, engrossed in the physician's desk reference. Several air mattresses were stacked against the wall. There was a long line at the emergency telephone, people calling relatives or trying to reach the switchboard at one or another radio call-in show. The radios here were tuned mainly to just such shows. Babette sat in a camp chair, going through a canvas bag full of snack thins and other provisions. I noticed jars and cartons that had been sitting in the refrigerator or cabinet for months.
"I thought this would be a good time to cut down on fatty things," she said.
"Why now, especially?"
"This is a time for discipline, mental toughness. We're practically at the edge."
"I think it's interesting that you regard a possible disaster for yourself, your family, and thousands of other people as an opportunity to cut down on fatty foods."
"You take discipline where you can find it," she said. "If I don't eat my yogurt now, I may as well stop buying the stuff forever. Except I think I'll skip the wheat germ."
The brand name was foreign-looking. I picked up the jar of wheat germ and examined the label closely. "It's German," I told her. "Eat it." There were people in pajamas and slippers, a man with a rifle slung over his shoulder, kids crawling into sleeping bags. Babette gestured, wanting me to lean closer.
"Let's keep the radio turned off," she whispered, "so the girls can't hear. They haven't gotten beyond déjà vu. I want to keep it that way."
"What if the symptoms are real?"
"How could they be real?"
"Why couldn't they be real?"
"They get them only when they're broadcast," she whispered.
"Did Steffi hear about déjà vu on the radio?"
"She must have."
"How do you know? Were you with her when it was broadcast?"
"I'm not sure."
"Think hard."
"I can't remember."
"Do you remember telling her what déjà vu means?" She spooned some yogurt out of the carton, seemed to pause, deep in thought.
"This happened before," she said finally.
"What happened before?"
"Eating yogurt, sitting here, talking about déjà vu."
"I don't want to hear this."
"The yogurt was on my spoon. I saw it in a flash. The whole experience. Natural, whole milk, low fat."
The yogurt was still on the spoon. I watched her put the spoon to her mouth, thoughtfully, trying to measure the action against the illusion of a matching original. From my squatting position, I motioned her to lean closer.
"Heinrich seems to be coming out of his shell," I whispered. "Where is he? I haven't seen him."
"See that knot of people? He's right in the middle. He's telling them what he knows about the toxic event."
"What does he know?"
"Quite a lot, it turns out."
"Why didn't he tell us?" she whispered.
"He's probably tired of us. He doesn't think it's worth his while to be funny and charming in front of his family. That's the way sons are. We represent the wrong kind of challenge."
"Funny and charming?"
"I guess he had it in him all the while. It was a question of finding the right time to exercise his gifts." She moved closer, our heads almost touching.
"Don't you think you ought to go over there?" she said. "Let him see you in the crowd. Show him that his father is present at his big moment."
"He'll only get upset if he sees me in the crowd."
"Why?"
"I'm his father."
So if you go over there, you'll ruin things by embarrassing him and cramping his style because of the father-son thing. And if you don't go over, he'll never know you saw him in his big moment, and he'll think he has to behave in your presence the way he's always behaved, sort of peevishly and defensive, instead of in this new, delightful, and expansive manner. It's a double bind. What if I went over? She whispered. He'll think I sent you. Would that be so awful? He thinks I use you to get him to do what I want. There may be some truth in that, Jack. But then what are step-parents for if they can't be used in little skirmishes between blood relatives? I moved still closer, lowered my voice even more. Just a lifesaver, I said. What? Just some saliva that you didn't know what to do with. It was a lifesaver, she whispered, making an O with her thumb and index finger. Give me one. It was the last one. What flavor? Quick. Cherry. I puckered my lips and made little sucking sounds. The black man with the tracts came over and squatted next to me. We engaged in an earnest and prolonged handshake. He studied me openly, giving the impression that he had traveled this rugged distance, uprooting his family, not to escape the chemical event, but to find the one person who would understand what he had to say. It's happening everywhere, isn't it? More or less, I said. And what's the government doing about it? Nothing. You said it. I didn't. There's only one word in the language to describe what's being done, and you found it exactly. I'm not surprised at all. But when you think about it, what can they do? Because what is coming is definitely coming. No government in the world is big enough to stop it. Does a man like yourself know the size of India's standing army? 1 million. I didn't say it. You did. 1 million soldiers, and they can't stop it. Do you know who's got the biggest standing army in the world? It's either China or Russia, although the Vietnamese ought to be mentioned. Tell me this, he said. Can the Vietnamese stop it? No. It's here, isn't it? People feel it. We know in our bones. God's kingdom is coming. He was a rangy man with sparse hair and a gap between his two front teeth. He squatted easily, seemed loose-jointed and comfortable. I realized he was wearing a suit and tie with running shoes. "Are these great days?" he said. I studied his face, trying to find a clue to the right answer. "Do you feel it coming? Is it on the way? Do you want it to come?" He bounced on his toes as he spoke. "Wars, famines, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions. It's all beginning to gel. In your own words, is there anything that can stop it from coming once it picks up momentum?" "No." "You said it. I didn't. Floods, tornadoes, epidemics of strange new diseases. Is it a sign? Is it the truth? Are you ready?" "Do people really feel it in their bones?" I said. "Good news travels fast. Do people talk about it? On your door-to-door visits, do you get the impression they want it?" "It's not do they want it. It's where do I go to sign up? It's get me out of here right now. People ask, is there seasonal change in God's kingdom? They ask, are there bridge tolls and returnable bottles? In other words, I'm saying they're getting right down to it." "You feel it's a groundswell. A sudden gathering, exactly put." I took one look and I knew. This is a man who understands. "Earthquakes are not up statistically." He gave me a condescending smile. I felt it was richly deserved, although I wasn't sure why. Maybe it was prissy to be quoting statistics in the face of powerful beliefs, fears, desires. "How do you plan to spend your resurrection?" he said, as though asking about a long weekend coming up. "We all get one." "You're either among the wicked or among the saved. The wicked get to rot as they walk down the street. They get to feel their own eyes slide out of their sockets. You'll know them by their stickiness and lost parts. People tracking slime of their own making. All the flashiness of Armageddon is in the rotting. The saved know each other by their neatness and reserve. He doesn't have showy ways is how you know a saved person." He was a serious man. He was matter-of-fact and practical, down to his running shoes. I wondered about his eerie self-assurance, his freedom from doubt. Is this the point of Armageddon? No ambiguity, no more doubt? He was ready to run into the next world. He was forcing the next world to seep into my consciousness, stupendous events that seemed matter-of-fact to him, self-evident, reasonable, imminent, true. I did not feel Armageddon in my bones, but I worried about all those people who did, who were ready for it, wishing hard, making phone calls and bank withdrawals. If enough people want it to happen, will it happen? How many people are enough people? Why are we talking to each other from this aboriginal crouch? He handed me a pamphlet called 20 Common Mistakes About the End of the World. I struggled out of the squatting posture, feeling dizziness and back pain. At the front of the hall, a woman was saying something about exposure to toxic agents. Her small voice was almost lost in the shuffling roar of the barracks, the kind of low-level rumble that humans routinely make in large enclosed places. Denise had put down her reference work and was giving me a hard-eyed look. It was the look she usually saved for her father and his latest loss of foothold. "What's wrong?" I said to her.
"Didn't you hear what the voice said?"
"Exposure."
"That's right," she said sharply.
"What's that got to do with us?"
"Not us," she said. "You."
"Why me?"
"Aren't you the one who got out of the car to fill the gas tank?"
"Where was the airborne event when I did that?"
"Just ahead of us. Don't you remember? You got back in the car, and we went a little ways, and then there it was in all those lights."
"You're saying when I got out of the car the cloud may have been close enough to rain all over me?"
"It's not your fault," she said impatiently, "but you were practically right in it for about 2.5 minutes.
I made my way up front. Two lines were forming, A to M and N to Z. At the end of each line was a folding table with a microcomputer on it. Technicians milled about, men and women with lapel badges and color-coded armbands. I stood behind the life jacket-wearing family. They looked bright, happy, and well-drilled. The thick orange vests did not seem especially out of place, even though we were on more or less dry land, well above sea level, many miles from the nearest ominous body of water. Stark upheavals bring out every sort of quaint aberration by the very suddenness of their coming. Dashes of color and idiosyncrasy marked the scene from beginning to end. The lines were not long. When I reached the A to M desk, the man seated there typed out data on his keyboard. My name, age, medical history, so on. He was a gaunt young man who seemed suspicious of conversation that strayed outside certain unspecified guidelines. Over the left sleeve on his khaki jacket he wore a green armband bearing the word Simuvac. I related the circumstances of my presumed exposure.
"How long were you out there?"
2.5 minutes, I said. "Is that considered long or short?" "Anything that puts you in contact with actual emissions means we have a situation." "Why didn't the drifting cloud disperse in all that wind and rain?"
This is not your everyday Cirrus. This is a high-definition event. It is packed with dense concentrations of byproduct. You could almost toss a hook in there and tow it out to sea, which I'm exaggerating to make a point. What about people in the car? I had to open the door to get out and get back in. There are known degrees of exposure. I'd say their situation is their minimal risks. It's the 2.5 minutes standing right in it that makes me wince. Actual skin and orifice contact. This is Niodine D, a whole new generation of toxic waste. What we call state-of-the-art. One part per million can send a rat into a permanent state. He regarded me with the grimly superior air of a combat veteran. Obviously, he didn't think much of people whose complacent and overprotected lives did not allow for encounters with brain-dead rats. I wanted this man on my side. He had access to data. I was prepared to be servile and fawning if it would keep him from dropping casually shattering remarks about my degree of exposure and chances for survival. That's quite an armband you've got there. What does Simuvac mean? Sounds important. Short for Simulated Evacuation. A new state program they're still battling over funds for. But this evacuation isn't simulated, it's real. We know that, but we thought we could use it as a model. A form of practice? Are you saying you saw a chance to use the real event in order to rehearse the simulation? We took it right into the streets. How's it going? I said. The insertion curve isn't as smooth as we would like. There's a probability excess. Plus which, we don't have our victims laid out where we'd want them if this was an actual simulation. In other words, we're forced to take our victims as we find them. We didn't get a jump on computer traffic. Suddenly it just spilled out, three-dimensionally, all over the landscape. You have to make allowances for the fact that everything we see tonight is real. There's a lot of polishing we still have to do, but that's what this exercise is all about. What about the computers? Is that real data you're running through the system, or is it just practice stuff? You watch, he said. He spent a fair amount of time tapping on the keys and then studying coded responses on the data screen. A considerably longer time, it seemed to me, than he'd devoted to the people who'd preceded me in line. In fact, I began to feel that others were watching me. I stood with my arms folded, trying to create a picture of an impassive man. Someone in line at a hardware store waiting for the girl at the register to ring up his heavy-duty rope. It seemed the only way to neutralize events, to counteract the passage of computerized dots that registered my life and death. Look at no one, reveal nothing, remain still. The genius of the primitive mind is that it can render human helplessness in noble and beautiful ways. You're generating big numbers, he said, peering at the screen. I was out there only 2.5 minutes. That's how many seconds? It's not just you were out there so many seconds. It's your whole data profile. I tapped into your history. I'm getting bracketed numbers with pulsing stars. What does that mean? You'd rather not know. He made a silencing gesture as if something of particular morbid interest was appearing on the screen. I wondered what he meant when he'd said he'd tapped into my history. Where was it located, exactly? Some state or federal agency? Some insurance company or credit firm or medical clearinghouse? What history was he referring to? I told him some basic things, height, weight, childhood diseases. What else did he know? Did he know about my wives, my involvement with Hitler, my dreams and fears? He had a skinny neck and jug-handle ears to go with his starved skull, the innocent pre-war look of a rural murderer. Am I going to die? Not as such, he said. What do you mean? Not in so many words. How many words does it take? It's not a question of words.
It's a question of years. We'll know more in 15 years. In the meantime, we definitely have a situation.
What will we know in 15 years?
If you're still alive at the time, we'll know that much more than we do now. Niadine D has a lifespan of 30 years. You'll have made it halfway through.
I thought it was 40 years.
40 years in the soil, 30 years in the human body.
So, to outlive this substance, I will have to make it into my 80s. Then I can begin to relax.
Knowing what we know at this time.
But the general consensus seems to be that we don't know enough at this time to be sure of anything.
Well, let me answer like so. If I was a rat, I wouldn't want to be anywhere within a 200-mile radius of the airborne event.
What if you were a human?
He looked at me carefully. I stood with my arms folded, staring over his head toward the front door of the barracks. To look at him would be to declare my vulnerability.
I wouldn't worry about what I can't see or feel, he said. I'd go ahead and live my life, get married, settle down, have kids. There's no reason you can't do these things, knowing what we know.
But you said we have a situation.
I didn't say it. The computer did. The whole system says it. It's what we call a massive database tally. Gladney, J-A-K. I punch in the name, the substance, the exposure time, and then I tap into your computer history. Your genetics, your personals, your medicals, your psychologicals, your police and hospitals. It comes back pulsing stars. This doesn't mean anything is going to happen to you as such, at least not today or tomorrow. It just means you are the sum total of your data. No man escapes that.
And this massive so-called tally is not a simulation despite that armband you're wearing. It is real.
It is real, he said.
I stood absolutely still. If they thought I was already dead, they might be inclined to leave me alone. I think I felt as I would if a doctor had held an X-ray to the light showing a star-shaped hole at the center of one of my vital organs. Death has entered. It is inside you. You are said to be dying and yet are separate from the dying, can ponder it at your leisure, literally see on the X-ray photograph or computer screen the horrible alien logic of it all. It is when death is rendered graphically, is televised, so to speak, that you sense an eerie separation between your condition and yourself. A network of symbols has been introduced, an entire awesome technology wrested from the gods. It makes you feel like a stranger in your own dying.
I wanted my academic gown and dark glasses.
When I got back to the other end of the barracks, the three younger children were asleep. Heinrich was making notations on a road map, and Babette was seated some distance away with Old Man Treadwell and a number of other blind people. She was reading to them from a small and brightly colored stack of supermarket tabloids. I needed a distraction. I found a camp chair and set it near the wall behind Babette. There were four blind people, a nurse and three sighted people, arranged in a semicircle facing the reader. Others occasionally paused to listen to an item or two, then moved on. Babette employed her storytelling voice, the same sincere and lilting tone she used when she read fairy tales to Wilder or erotic passages to her husband in their brass bed, high above the headlong traffic hum. She reported a front-page story. Life after death guaranteed with bonus coupons. Then turned to the designated page. Scientists at Princeton's famed Institute for Advanced Studies have stunned the world by presenting absolute and undeniable proof of life after death. A researcher at the world-renowned institute has used hypnosis to induce hundreds of people to recall their previous life experiences as pyramid builders, exchange students, and extraterrestrials. Babette changed her voice to do dialogue.
In the last year alone, declares reincarnation hypnotist Ling Tiwan, I have helped hundreds to regress to previous lives under hypnosis. One of my most amazing subjects was a woman who was able to recall her life as a hunter-gatherer in the Mesolithic era 10,000 years ago. It was remarkable to hear this tiny senior citizen in polyester slacks describe her life as a hulking male chieftain whose band inhabited a peat bog and hunted wild boar with primitive bow and arrow. She was able to identify features of that era which only a trained archaeologist could know about. She even spoke several phrases in the language of that day, a tongue remarkably similar to modern-day German. Babette's voice resumed its tone of straight narration. Dr. Shiv Chatterjee, fitness guru and high-energy physicist, recently stunned a live TV audience by relating the well-documented case of two women, unknown to each other, who came to him for regression in the same week, only to discover that they had been twin sisters in the lost city of Atlantis 50,000 years ago. Both women described the city, before its mysterious and catastrophic plunge into the sea, as a clean and well-run municipality where you could walk safely almost any time of day or night. Today they are food stylists for NASA. Even more startling is the case of 5-year-old Patty Weaver, who has made convincing claims to Dr. Chatterjee that in her previous life experience she was the secret KGB assassin responsible for the unsolved murders of famed personalities Howard Hughes, Marilyn Monroe, and Elvis Presley. Known in international espionage circles as the Viper, for the deadly and untraceable venom he injected into the balls of the feet of his celebrity victims, the assassin died in a fiery Moscow helicopter crash just hours before little Patty Weaver was born in Popular Mechanics, Iowa. She not only has the same bodily markings as the Viper, but seems to have a remarkable knack for picking up Russian words and phrases. "I regressed this subject at least a dozen times," says Dr. Chatterjee. "I used the toughest professional techniques to get her to contradict herself. But her story is remarkably consistent. It is a tale of the good that can come from evil." Says little Patty, "At the moment of my death as the Viper, I saw a glowing circle of light. It seemed to welcome me, to beckon. It was a warm spiritual experience. I just walked right toward it. I was not sad at all." Babette did the voices of Dr. Chatterjee and Patty Weaver. Her Chatterjee was a warm and mellow Indian-accented English, with clipped phrasing. She did Patty as a child hero in a contemporary movie, the only person on screen who is unawed by mysterious throbbing phenomena. In a further startling development, it was revealed by little Patty that the three super celebrities were murdered for the same astonishing reason. Each of them, at the time of his or her death, was in secret possession of the Holy Shroud of Turin, famed for its sacred curative powers. Entertainers Elvis and Marilyn were drink and drug nightmare victims, and secretly hoped to restore spiritual and bodily calm to their lives by actually drying themselves with the Holy Shroud after poor cleansing sessions in the sauna. Multifaceted billionaire Howard Hughes suffered from stop-action blink syndrome, a bizarre condition which prevented his eyes from reopening for hours after a simple blink, and he obviously hoped to utilize the amazing power of the shroud until the Viper intervened with a swift injection of phantom venom. Patty Weaver has further revealed under hypnosis that the KGB has long sought possession of the Shroud of Turin on behalf of the rapidly aging and pain-racked members of the Politburo, the famed executive committee of the Communist Party. Possession of the Shroud is said to be the real motive behind the attempted assassination of Pope John Paul II at the Vatican, an attempt that failed
only because the Viper had already died in a horror helicopter crash and been reborn as a freckle-faced girl in Iowa. The no-risk bonus coupon below gives you guaranteed access to dozens of documented cases of life after death, everlasting life, previous life experiences, posthumous life in outer space, transmigration of souls, and personalized resurrection through stream-of-consciousness computer techniques. I studied the faces in the semicircle. No one seemed amazed by this account. Old Man Treadwell lit a cigarette, impatient with his own trembling hand, forced to shake out the flame before it burned him. There was no interest shown in discussion. The story occupied some recess of passive belief. There it was, familiar and comforting in its own strange way. A set of statements no less real than our daily quota of observable household fact. Even Babette, in her tone of voice, betrayed no sign of skepticism or condescension. Surely I was in no position to feel superior to these elderly listeners, blind or sighted. Little Patty's walk toward the warm, welcoming glow found me in a weakened and receptive state. I wanted to believe at least this part of the tale. Babette read an ad. The Stanford Linear Accelerator, 3-Day Particle-Smashing Diet. She picked up another tabloid. The cover story concerned the country's leading psychics and their predictions for the coming year. She read the items slowly. Squadrons of UFOs will invade Disney World and Cape Canaveral. In a startling twist, the attack will be revealed as a demonstration of the folly of war, leading to a nuclear test ban treaty between the U.S. and Russia. The ghost of Elvis Presley will be seen taking lonely walks at dawn around Graceland, his musical mansion. A Japanese consortium will buy Air Force One and turn it into a luxury flying condominium with mid-air refueling privileges and air-to-surface missile capability. Bigfoot will appear dramatically at a campsite in the rugged and scenic Pacific Northwest. The hairy, upright man-beast, who stands 8 feet tall and may be evolution's missing link, will gently welcome tourists to gather around him, revealing himself to be an apostle of peace. UFOs will raise the lost city of Atlantis from its watery grave in the Caribbean by telekinetic means and the help of powerful cables with properties not known in Earth-like materials. The result will be a city of peace where money and passports are totally unknown. The spirit of Lyndon B. Johnson will contact CBS executives to arrange an interview on live TV in order to defend itself against charges made in recent books. Beatle assassin Mark David Chapman will legally change his name to John Lennon and begin a new career as a rock lyricist from his prison cell on Murderer's Row. Members of an air crash cult will hijack a jumbo jet and crash it into the White House in an act of blind devotion to their mysterious and reclusive leader, known only as Uncle Bob. The President and First Lady will miraculously survive with minor cuts, according to close friends of the couple. Dead multi-billionaire Howard Hughes will mysteriously appear in the sky over Las Vegas. Wonder Drugs, mass-produced aboard UFO pharmaceutical labs in the weightless environment of space, will lead to cures for anxiety, obesity, and mood swings. From beyond the grave, dead living legend John Wayne will communicate telepathically with President Reagan to help frame U.S. foreign policy. Mellowed by death, the strapping actor will advocate a hopeful policy of peace and love. 60s super killer Charles Manson will break out of prison and terrorize the California countryside for weeks before negotiating a surrender on live TV in the offices of International Creative Management. Earth's only satellite, the Moon,
will explode on a humid night in July, playing havoc with tides and raining dirt and debris over much of our planet. But UFO cleanup crews will help avert a worldwide disaster, signaling an era of peace and harmony. I watch the audience. Folded arms, heads slightly tilted. The predictions did not seem reckless to them. They were content to exchange brief and unrelated remarks, as during a break for a commercial on TV. The tabloid future, with its mechanism of a hopeful twist to apocalyptic events, was perhaps not so very remote from our own immediate experience. Look at us, I thought, forced out of our homes, sent streaming into the bitter night, pursued by a toxic cloud, crammed together in makeshift quarters, ambiguously death-sentenced. We'd become part of the public stuff of media disaster. The small audience of the old and blind recognized the predictions of the psychics as events so near to happening that they had to be shaped in advance to our needs and wishes. Out of some persistent sense of large-scale ruin, we kept inventing hope. Babette read an ad for diet sunglasses. The old people listened with interest. I went back to our area. I wanted to be near the children, watch them sleep. Watching children sleep makes me feel devout, part of a spiritual system. It is the closest I can come to God. If there is a secular equivalent of standing in a great spired cathedral with marble pillars and streams of mystical light slanting through two-tier Gothic windows, it would be watching children in their little bedrooms fast asleep. Girls especially. Most of the lights were out now. The barracks roar had subsided. People were settling in. Heinrich was still awake, sitting on the floor, fully dressed, his back to the wall, reading a Red Cross resuscitation manual. He was not in any case a child whose lustrous slumber brought me peace. A restless, teeth-grinding and erratic sleeper, the boy sometimes fell from his bed, to be found in a fetal bundle by early light, shivering on the hardwood floor. "They seem to have things under control," I said. "Who?" "Whoever's in charge out there." "Who's in charge?" "Never mind." "It's like we've been flung back in time," he said. "Here we are in the Stone Age, knowing all these great things after centuries of progress, but what can we do to make life easier for the Stone Agers? Can we make a refrigerator? Can we even explain how it works? What is electricity? What is light? We experience these things every day of our lives, but what good does it do if we find ourselves hurled back in time and we can't even tell people the basic principles, much less actually make something that would improve conditions? Name one thing you could make. Could you make a simple wooden match that you could strike on a rock to make a flame? We think we're so great and modern. Moon landings, artificial hearts. But what if you were hurled into a time warp and came face to face with the ancient Greeks? The Greeks invented trigonometry. They did autopsies and dissections. What could you tell an ancient Greek that he couldn't say, big deal? Could you tell him about the atom? Atom is a Greek word. The Greeks knew that the major events in the universe can't be seen by the eye of man. It's waves, it's rays, it's particles. We're doing all right. We're sitting in this huge, moldy room. It's like we're flung back. We have heat. We have light. These are Stone Age things. They had heat and light. They had fire. They rubbed flints together and made sparks. Could you rub flints together? Would you know a flint if you saw one? If a Stone Ager asked you what a nucleotide is, could you tell him? How do we make carbon paper? What is glass? If you came awake tomorrow in the Middle Ages and there was an epidemic raging, what could you do to stop it, knowing what you know about the progress of medicines and diseases? Here it is, practically the 21st century, and you've read hundreds of books and magazines and seen 100 TV shows about science and medicine. Could you tell those people one little crucial thing that might save 1.5 million lives?
Boil your water, I'd tell them.
Sure. What about wash behind your ears? That's about as good.
I still think we're doing fairly well. There was no warning. We have food, we have radios.
What is a radio? What is the principle of a radio?
Go ahead, explain.
You're sitting in the middle of this circle of people. They use pebble tools, they eat grubs. Explain a radio.
There's no mystery. Powerful transmitters send signals. They travel through the air to be picked up by receivers.
They travel through the air. What, like birds? Why not tell them magic?
They travel through the air in magic waves.
What is a nucleotide?
You don't know, do you?
Yet these are the building blocks of life.
What good is knowledge if it just floats in the air?
It goes from computer to computer. It changes and grows every second of every day. But nobody actually knows anything.
You know something. You know about Niadine D. I saw you with those people.
That was a one-time freak, he told me.
He went back to his reading.
I decided to get some air. Outside there were several groups of people standing around fires in 55-gallon drums. A man sold soft drinks and sandwiches from an open-sided vehicle. Parked nearby were school buses, motorcycles, smallish vans called ambulettes. I walked around a while. There were people asleep in cars, others pitching tents. Beams of light swung slowly through the woods, searching out sounds, calm voices calling. I walked past a carload of prostitutes from Iron City. The interior light was on, the faces occupied the windows. They resembled the checkout women at the supermarket, blondish, double-chinned, resigned. A man leaned against the front door on the driver's side, speaking through a small opening in the window, his breath showing white. A radio said, "Hog futures have declined in sympathy, adding bearishness to that market." I realized the man talking to the prostitutes was Murray J. Siskind. I walked over there, waited for him to finish his sentence before addressing him. He took off his right glove to shake my hand. The car window went up.
"I thought you were in New York for the term break."
"I came back early to look at car crash movies. Alphonse arranged a week of screenings to help me prepare for my seminar. I was on the airport bus heading in from Iron City when sirens started blowing. The driver didn't have much choice but to follow the traffic out here."
"Where are you spending the night?"
"The whole bus was assigned to one of the outbuildings. I heard a rumor about painted women and came out to investigate. One of them is dressed in leopard loungewear under her coat. She showed me. Another one says she has a snap-off crotch.
What do you think she means by that?"
"I'm a little worried, though, about all these outbreaks of lifestyle diseases. I carry a reinforced ribbed condom at all times. One size fits all. But I have a feeling it's not much protection against the intelligence and adaptability of the modern virus."
"The women don't seem busy," I said.
"I don't think this is the kind of disaster that leads to sexual abandon. One or two fellows might come skulking out eventually, but there won't be an orgiastic horde. Not tonight, anyway."
"I guess people need time to go through certain stages."
"It's obvious," he said. I told him I'd spent 2.5 minutes exposed to the toxic cloud. Then I summarized the interview I'd had with the Simuvac man. "That little breath of niadine has planted a death in my body. It is now official, according to the computer. I've got death inside me. It's just a question of whether or not I can outlive it. It has a lifespan of its own. 30 years. Even if it doesn't kill me in a direct way, it will probably outlive me in my own body. I could die in a plane crash, and the Niadine D would be thriving as my remains were laid to rest. "This is the nature of modern death," Murray said. "It has a life independent of us. It is growing in prestige and dimension. It has a sweep it never had before. We study it objectively. We can predict its appearance, trace its path in the body. We can take cross-section pictures of it, tape its tremors and waves. We've never been so close to it, so familiar with its habits and attitudes. We know it intimately. But it continues to grow, to acquire breadth and scope, new outlets, new passages and means. The more we learn, the more it grows. Is this some law of physics? Every advance in knowledge and technique is matched by a new kind of death, a new strain? Death adapts like a viral agent. Is it a law of nature, or some private superstition of mine? I sense that the dead are closer to us than ever. I sense that we inhabit the same air as the dead. Remember, Lao Tzu, there is no difference between the quick and the dead. They are one channel of vitality. He said this 600 years before Christ. It is true once again, perhaps more true than ever. He placed his hands on my shoulders and looked sadly into my face. He told me in the simplest words how sorry he was about what had happened. He talked to me about the likelihood of a computer error. Computers make mistakes, he said. Carpet static can cause a mistake. Some lint or hair in the circuits. He didn't believe this, and neither did I. But he spoke convincingly, his eyes filled with spontaneous emotion, a broad and profound feeling. I felt oddly rewarded. His compassion was equal to the occasion, an impressive pity and grief. The bad news was almost worth it. Ever since I was in my 20s, I had the fear, the dread. Now it's been realized. I feel enmeshed. I feel deeply involved. It's no wonder they call this thing the airborne toxic event. It's an event, all right. It marks the end of uneventful things. This is just the beginning. Wait and see. A talk show host said, "You are on the air." The fires burned in the oil drums. The sandwich vendor closed down his van. "Any episodes of déjà vu in your group?" "Wife and daughter," I said. "There's a theory about déjà vu." "I don't want to hear it." "Why do we think these things happened before?" "Simple. They did happen before, in our minds, as visions of the future. Because these are precognitions, we can't fit the material into our system of consciousness as it is now structured. This is basically supernatural stuff. We are seeing into the future but haven't learned how to process the experience. So it stays hidden until the precognition comes true, until we come face to face with the event. Now we are free to remember it, to experience it as familiar material." "Why are so many people having these episodes now?" "Because death is in the air," he said gently. "It is liberating suppressed material. It is getting us closer to things we haven't learned about ourselves. Most of us have probably seen our own death but haven't known how to make the material surface. Maybe when we die, the first thing we'll say is, 'I know this feeling. I was here before.'" He put his hands back on my shoulders, studied me with renewed and touching sadness. We heard the prostitutes call out to someone. "I'd like to lose interest in myself," I told Murray. "Is there any chance of that happening?" "None. Better men have tried." "I guess you're right." "It's obvious." "I wish there was something I could do. I wish I could outthink the problem." "Work harder on your Hitler," he said. I looked at him. How much did he know? The car window opened a crack. One of the women said to Murray, "All right, I'll do it for 25. "Have you checked with your representative?" he said.
She rolled down the window to peer at him. She had the opaque look of a hair-curled woman on the evening news whose house had been buried in mud.
"You know who I mean," Murray said, "the fellow who sees to your emotional needs in return.